This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey is away this week. Coming up, an historical look at police killings of blacks in New Orleans, a prison hunger strike in Virginia, and a new book on the contest between integrationism and black nationalism. But first, the U.S. Senate passed a bill that is now before the House that opponents say would roll back some of the rights guaranteed by the 1964 Civil Rights Act. The legislation ostensibly protects the rights of federal workers, but Marsha Coleman Adebayo, the noted whistleblower, says the bill contains a poison pill and is misnamed.
The bill is called the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act, and it's an interesting title, this word enhancement, because what in fact it does is subtract from the rights of African Americans and women and other people who have to go to a board within the U.S. judicial system called the Merit Systems Protection Board, MSPB. This board was designed to expedite the processing of racial Title VII complaints, race, sex, color, and national origin complaints. But in fact, this board, the MSPB, has really been utilized mostly by African Americans and women who simply oftentimes cannot afford to go to a lawyer and plop down a $40,000 retainer for an attorney. And so what they do is they go to this board, MSPB, and that's a place where they can represent themselves pro se if they like, and they can argue their case before what is called, again, an administrative judge. The reason why I keep saying what it's called is because nothing is as it seems. The reality is that the MSPB, although it's supposed to be sympathetic to federal workers and to discrimination complaints, in fact, it's extremely hostile to discrimination complainants and to sexual harassment complainants and to people with different origins. And as an example of that, the most graphic example that I can provide is that only 2% of all the people who will appear as victims of discrimination before the MSPB will prevail. So 98% of the time, the MSPB rules in favor of the government agency.
This sounds like a board where complaints go to die.
This is a place where not only complaints go to die, but the victims go to die as well, quite frankly, because they really have no other place to go. I've gone to the MSPB. I'm one of the victims of the MSPB system, so I really know about what I'm talking about. And the MSPB in the Washington, D.C. area is in the south. It's tucked into a southern town in Virginia. The MSPB, quote-unquote, administrative judges are not real judges. In fact, many of them don't even possess a law degree. They are federal government employees, GS-12s, GS-13s. And so literally you have this person, they don't even wear robes at MSPB, I don't believe. So you have this sort of charade of this person marching in, and the person who walked in my case, I think, had on a pair of jeans and a lumberjack shirt. So they come in and they have all the force of law on their side, and you're sitting there hoping, praying that they will hear what happened to you. You can call witnesses, you can have discovery, but these people are not real judges. Like I said, these are federal employees that are ruling on other federal employees, and they're actually being rated how well they perform in that position, obviously on behalf of the government. So this is a very destructive and serious situation. This MSPB should have been eradicated 10 years ago. It should have gone out of business 10 years ago. They don't even pretend anymore.
So these are judges who, in fact, work for the boss, the same boss that the complainants are complaining about.
That's right. That's right. And true to their calling, they always rule in favor of their boss. Now, when you go to MSPB and you lose your case, you can still take your case from MSPB and go into federal court. You have another opportunity to fight for justice. under a new law, the law that we're talking about, or a bill, it's, thank God it's still a bill, and that's what was just passed by the Senate, Senate Bill 743, the MSPB judges, or the charades, or the clowns, or whatever you want to call these people, will now have the power to assert what is called summary judgment. Now, what is summary judgment? Summary judgment is when a judge says there are no material differences. There are no facts of this case that would warrant the court listening any further to this complaint. Therefore, you are not entitled to go any further with your complaint. The complaint is dead. That's what's called summary judgment. You do not have access any further to a jury or any other legal mechanism. Your case is dead. So, for example, in my case, when the judge predictably ruled against me at MSPB, I was allowed to pick up my marbles and take them to federal court and continue my quest for justice. If this bill is passed, it means that all those blacks, all the women who take their cases to MSPB, 95-98%, the judges will rule summary judgment, and they will never see the inside of a courtroom. They will never have the opportunity to appeal to a jury for justice. That means, in a wider sense, that the 1964 Act, which gave us the right to a jury trial, has technically been overturned.
And you've described this as a betrayal of the goals of the civil rights movement.
It's absolutely a betrayal. One of the major problems that Dr. King and his cohorts were facing in the South was that black people were denied what was called due process. We were not permitted to have our day in court because some sheriff or some other law and policeman would just say, there's no case here, you know, go back home and keep tilling the land. And so one of the basic tenets of the civil rights movement was due process. We have a right to, like everyone else, to argue our case in front of a jury of our peers, and for the jury of our peers to render a decision. That's the highest decision we can have in this country outside of the Supreme Court. What summary judgment does is to say you no longer have a right to a jury of your peers. That this administrative judge who is a GS-13 or GS-14, who is a government official, will now say, we have now taken away that right from you. You no longer have due process.
This bill that would take away that right is now in the House, and one of its sponsors is Elijah Cummings, the black congressman.
Unfortunately, unbelievable.
Baltimore.
Yeah, it's just so incredibly sad because, you know, I personally can't believe that Congressman Cummings understands the implications of this law, that he is one of the top leadership. Now, the bill on the House side is H.R. 3289. I'll repeat that, H.R. 3289. Now, interestingly enough, you know, in the House, since the House is now controlled by Republicans, the primary sponsor of the bill on the House side is Daryl Issa from California.
A very conservative congressman.
Tea Party all the way. So you have one of the most conservative, anti-civil rights, anti-women, just right down the road, providing the leadership on the House side for this bill. So why is it that we have such a high-profile arch-conservative providing leadership for this bill? And I believe it's because of the summary judgment, that for the first time in so many years, Republicans get to finally overturn the 64th Civil Rights Act without anyone even knowing that it's happening.
Which is why you've asked President Obama to veto this bill if it does pass.
Exactly. Now, supposedly, President Obama is a civil rights attorney. And he, I believe, has gone on record saying if the bill reaches his desk, he will sign it. So I think it's incumbent upon all of us now to not only get in touch with Cummings and then Holland and make sure they take that provision out of the bill before it goes to conference, because I do think Republicans are going to vote this bill through the House. I think there's no way we can stop that. But I think in the House conference, they may be able to get Cummings and Van Hollen to try to take this provision out. Issa is a big proponent of the MSPB summary judgment, and my understanding is that he was the one that put it in the bill. So I doubt if they're going to be willing now to take it out of the bill. So our last hope, and this is really scary, but our last hope is for the president. If we put enough pressure on the president to say you do not want to be the president that has overturned the 1964 Civil Rights Act, maybe we can shame him into, maybe there's this deep, there'll be a moral moment for him where he does not want to go down in history as the president who actually overturned the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
Marsha Coleman Adebayo of the No Fear Coalition. New Orleans and the U.S. Justice Department are putting the finishing touches on a consent agreement that would monitor the city's police department, long troubled by racism and violence. Dr. Jeffrey Adler, a professor of history and criminology at the University of Florida, recently published an article in the prestigious Law and History Review titled The Killer Behind the Badge, Race and Police Homicide in New Orleans, 1925 to 1945. We asked Professor Adler why he chose New Orleans and why that period of history.
I guess there are two reasons. One is that it's a very violent city, or it was a very violent city at the beginning of the 20th century, and it continues to be a very violent city with a particularly toxic racial environment. So this was a way of studying race and violence. And the other reason is essentially that I could do it, that an unusual set of records have survived, and by examining those records, I could measure with precision conflict and violence involving the police, whereas in other places, it's very, very hard to measure that because the police haven't kept or maintained accurate records.
You say in your article that the history of police homicide has received little attention. It's received a lot of attention in Black America because, well, police violence is so much a part of Black history.
I think it's received a lot of attention. I think the portion of it that hasn't received attention, at least from historians, is to figure out exactly how often it occurred and where it occurred and why it occurred. So I think you're absolutely right that the overall issue permeates urban life, permeates race relations. But the test is when and where and why, and how did that change over time? And that's the dimension that maybe hasn't received as much attention.
Well, how has it changed over time in New Orleans?
I'm more comfortable talking about the early 19th century than the present because I am a historian and the sources I looked at are historical. But I guess the larger issue is that the basic problem hasn't completely changed. African Americans are much more likely to be shot by police than are white residents. They're more likely to be shot by police for committing either minor or very, very kind of trivial offenses. They're much more likely to be perceived to be reaching for the police officer's weapon or challenging police officer in some other way. So I think the basic contours haven't changed as much as we'd like. On the other hand, the level has changed, that police culture isn't what it was 100 years ago, and legal restrictions on police and cop culture had changed as well. The result is that it's still an immense problem, but the degree, the level, the number isn't what it was 100 years ago.
Why does New Orleans stand out then and now as such a violent city? One of the things that historically comes to mind is that we remember New Orleans was a battleground between ex-Confederates and federal troops and Black ex-soldiers. Two battles fought over New Orleans right after the Civil War and the famous New Orleans riot of 66. We're talking about a history of organized racial violence that goes way back.
That's certainly true. Part of it is regional. Part of it's that the South has had more violent race relations than much of the rest of the country. But part of it is distinct to Louisiana and to New Orleans, where some of those problems were more pronounced and I think are probably still more pronounced. At least in the 19th and 20th centuries, New Orleans politics were especially suspect, especially corrupt in some ways. New Orleans professionalized its law enforcement much later than even other southern cities. So I think what you have is a regional pattern, but it's exaggerated by factors disproportionate both to Louisiana and to New Orleans.
You note that between 1925 and 1945, only one policeman was convicted of killing a civilian in that whole 20-year period.
Correct, and that case was so extreme that it was the proverbial exception that proved the rule, that even police officials couldn't defend the behavior of that one New Orleans police officer who announced that he was about to rape a 14-year-old African-American girl, and when he resisted in front of, in the presence of a lot of white observers, he shot her and bragged and crowed about it. Anything short of that led to an exoneration, though.
In what year was the New Orleans Police Department, at least token, integrated?
Two-part answer. It had a brief period after the Civil War during Reconstruction when it was integrated. That did not last very long. By the 1870s, the New Orleans Police Department was all white again, and I believe the first African-American police officers were either the late 1940s or 1950, and that's a good deal later than virtually every other southern city.
And why is it that the civil rights movement did not seem to make New Orleans police less lethal, at least less lethal in the black community?
I think police violence was a crucial issue in fueling the formation of a strong civil rights movement in Louisiana and in New Orleans. So in some ways, I think it did produce a strong reaction. I think the problems were more entrenched. I think the level of training, the lack of professional standards, the corruption of politics were more powerful and more deeply entrenched in New Orleans than in many other southern cities or other cities. So there was a strong counter-movement, but it had more work to do. It faced more formidable challenges than in most other cities in the United States, even southern cities.
More formidable challenges because of the endemic corruption?
Yeah. So you have a city that is very poor, that historically has been very poor, a city that, as you indicated, has a long and deep record of racial conflict and racial acrimony, and an institutional structure, a legal structure, and a political structure, and a bureaucratic structure that was remarkably resistant to a lot of the modernization movements of the 20th century, certainly the early 20th century. So whereas by the turn of the century, the beginning of the 20th century, most southern cities were beginning to require training for police officers, were beginning to have civil service standards for law enforcers. New Orleans wasn't doing that, or to the extent that it did, it actually eliminated those reforms until the middle decades of the 20th century. So it was two or three or four or five decades behind in terms of modernization and legal and institutional reform than many other southern cities.
And we see from some of the horror stories of the last two decades, horror stories in terms of police abuse of civilians, that these black police officers were also integrated into this endemic corruption and violence.
Again, this extends beyond what I have particular expertise in, but the literature from criminologists supports exactly your argument, and that is that African-American officers have faced so much pressure to be a part of a law enforcement unit that they're encouraged to be tougher on African-Americans. And in some cases, that's led to the same kinds of abuses by African-American police officers as white police officers. Now, I think a lot of that's changing, but the problem has not disappeared. And that's why both the integration of police departments and even the ascent of African-Americans to the position of mayor or police chief hasn't eliminated some of these problems, although it's certainly improved them. What I found most interesting is the way in which there was a kind of self-perpetuating cycle where the more aggressive white cops became because they perceived resistance as a threat to social stability, the more it logically encouraged African Americans to not simply submit. And the more they African Americans suspects were perceived to resist, the more it reinforced the inclination of white policemen to use violence because they felt more and more threatened.
This whole question of threat, do policemen feel threats to actually their physical being, or is a threat to authority and to white authority in the case of white policemen, is a threat to authority then translated as a threat to their physical being and inseparable from that?
I think you're right. You can't separate them. If, particularly 100 years ago, if police officers believed that social stability was bound up in rendering African Americans submissive and compliant, then they understood resistance as a threat, and their bodies clearly would have reacted in ways consistent with a physical threat, and then state law said that if they felt threatened, they could shoot. So the images, the cultural images, perceptions are actually shaping behavior in a remarkably powerful and persistent way.
And in fact, that's not just something that's peculiar to New Orleans. We all know about the Sean Bell and Diallo shootings in New York City.
That's true. And you can apply some of the same science to soldiers in Iraq or Afghanistan, where things that really aren't threatening in that environment, in that charged environment, produce a kind of behavior that results in civilians, unarmed civilians, innocent civilians being shot. But when we look at soldiers, it seems understandable. When we look at cops on the beat in a familiar place, it's harder to make sense of that. But you're right that there are a broad range of examples throughout the last 200 years, but even the last 10 years, where policemen, as in Amadou Diallo, policemen believe that they've seen a gun when, in fact, no gun has existed. And one interpretation is that they're just lying. Another interpretation is that they inhabit a world in which that association between race and threat is so powerful that they may have, in fact, believed that they saw a gun, but the result is the same.
Professor Jeffrey Adler of the University of Florida. Inmates at Virginia's notorious Red Onion maximum security prison went on hunger strike last week. Reports differ on the number of inmates involved. We spoke with Max Gaskins, who spent 4 years locked up in Red Onion Prison and is a founding member of the group Supporting Prisoners and Acting for Radical Change, or SPARC. Gaskins has intimate knowledge of the conditions that confront inmates at Red Onion.
These men, I mean, they're subjected to some of the worst conditions you can think of. During my time there, I would be refused meals for no reason at all. I would be strapped to bed for days. They have this practice called five-point restraints where they strap you to a bed and you're forced to defecate on yourself, urinate on yourself. It does. I mean, there's this racial dynamic that exists there. I mean, it's like it's out of control. To really understand those prisons, you have to understand where they're built, how they came into existence. It's called Pound, Virginia. It's a very small town, maybe 1,000 people in the whole town. There's probably more people in the prison than in the town. All white, mostly poor whites, and a lot of them have never interacted with blacks until the first busload of prisoners came in to that prison. It's a coal mine town, and when the coal mines disappeared, there were no jobs, no economic depression. It was easy for them to sell this whole idea of bringing in prison and creating jobs. Who turns down a job when they're trying to feed their families? Yeah, they brought these guys in, man, and, like, I don't know. It's just this dynamic, man. The prisoners weren't ready for that, nor were the guards. But, yeah, the hunger strike is coming to existence because of the conditions, man. The food is not only of a poor quality, and it's not enough, undercooked. You have guards that are, like, calling prisoners very, very derogatory terms, like derogatory names and terms. They also have a practice of unleashing dogs on prisoners. You know, you live under the threat of a 12-gauge shotgun. They're shooting rubber bullets, but when I was there, I saw them get their eyes shot out. They were shot in the back and paralyzed. My friend, he was shot in the face not long ago, and that was a rubber bullet. He was shot in the face, live ammo. Anytime you're outside, that's live ammo. You're not really outside. He was in what's considered a rat cage, which is something like a dog kennel. This plexiglass enclosure that's surrounded by cage, and you're inside. The top is cut off, so it gives the illusion that you're outside. All you can see is the sky. Yeah, I mean, it's just horrible conditions there, man. Sensory deprivation. When you're in your cell, there are no windows, so you're totally disconnected from nature. Anything outside of the prison, you're almost supposed to be cut off from any sort of human interaction other than with the guard. Very hostile. Yeah, that's what produced the hunger strike. Just the conditions, man. You know, deny the most basic of human rights.
It sounds like you're not just dealing with the harsh conditions of a maximum security prison, but with some sadistic racism on the part of the guards.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's out of control. It's very, very, very racist, very sadistic.
The prisoners have released a set of 10 demands.
They are reasonable demands. They all simply amount to the most basic of human rights, having access to fully cooked food, having access to enough food to meet their nutritional needs. That's the first demand. Having access to adequate medical care, to have some outside organization or some third party to conduct investigations. So it's not simply an internal thing, and there's no sense of accountability. Having better communication between guards, higher-ranking guards and prisoners, having access to adequate cleaning materials. Right now, if you want to clean your cell at Red Onion, they give you a sponge, which they spray twice with disinfect, some sort of diluted chemical, and you're expected to clean your whole cell with that. No broom, no mop, no nothing.
Including the toilet.
You're expected to use one roll of toilet paper a week. Who uses one roll of toilet paper a week? Very basic stuff. If anything, they could actually be asking for a lot more. They're asking to be transferred on time. This prison, you're supposed to meet a certain criteria in order to be sent there. When they first built this prison, it was supposed to be for the most dangerous criminals. I don't like that word, but the most dangerous prisoners in the system are the prisoners with the most time to serve. They quickly found that based solely on that, they wouldn't have enough prisoners to fill that prison. So many infractions, very minor infractions that another institution will get you sent there. You build up a reputation, as I did, as somewhat of a freedom fighter, someone that organizes other prisoners against injustice. You'll be sent there. They have a point system in Virginia, which determines what security level prison you're held in, warehoused in, and they don't adhere to it. When I left prison, I had 1 point, which puts me at pre-release, and I was held in a maximum security prison at Wallace Ridge. So it's just simple stuff like that. These guys want to be treated like human beings. They want to get transferred to institutions which are closer to their families, like visits. They don't want to die chronic illnesses that can be treated. When I was there, a young man, he died from undiagnosed advanced diabetes. Simply because the prison, I mean, it's not like they come around every 3 months to take your blood pressure, test you for diabetes. Sickly, when you get sent to a place like Red Onion, that's probably where you're going to die.
Originally, there were about 4 dozen prisoners on hunger strike. The corporate media is saying that only about 7 are still on strike.
The place is so secluded. The officials are being very misleading about the members. I just read an article where they were lying and saying that there was no hunger strike, even though they contradicted themselves by saying that there were men that had missed 9 meals. That means these men had an 8 and 3/8, but it still didn't meet their standard of a hunger strike.
Now, as you said, the place is secluded, but how can people who want to act in solidarity, who are supportive of these inmates, how can they do that?
They can get on the mailing list. They can start writing to the prisoners in Virginia. You can persist to say hi, and we're standing with you. These men have made the choice to risk their lives in order to get some better living conditions.
That was activist and former Red Onion prison inmate Max Gaskins. People wanting to express their support for the hunger strikers can go to the website virginiaprotestststrike.blogspot.com. A new book is out that argues that left-wing black nationalists of the 1960s, such as the Black Panther Party, articulated the most advanced approach to racial justice. Gary Peller is a professor of critical race studies at Georgetown University. His book is titled Critical Race Consciousness, Rethinking American Ideologies of Racial Justice. Professor Peller says the integrationist wing of the black movement was not equipped to deal with economic and power disparities in U.S. society.
In my opinion, the black community in America is in crisis on many different fronts. And unlike various other historical times, I mean, there have been other times like this, but in contrast, say, to the times during the 60s, early 70s, I don't see strategies or plans for moving the community forward. And so what I've tried to do is to analyze what the ideological roots are of the current kind of frozen situation. And as I see the situation, the African-American middle class has partly been successfully integrated into the American mainstream and has, maybe to a greatest extent in its history, cut ties with the black working class and poor. And white liberals and progressives who traditionally were allies for black empowerment and a black liberation movement since, I'd say, the late 1970s have kind of had a hands-off policy under what I think is a misguided idea that they're respecting black self-determination if they kind of neglect the interests of the black community. So that's what I see is the current situation. I tried to kind of think backwards. How could we have gotten to this particular point when we have elected an African-American president, there are proclamations of the progress and racial enlightenment of American culture at this point? And in my analysis, the kind of key point is the conceptualization, the thinking of racism in a particular kind of way, an ideology of thinking of what racism is and what racial justice consists of, that I call integrationism. And what I'm talking about is thinking of racism in terms of being biased towards people or having stereotypes, thinking racism is a mental mistake, a mistake of prejudice that people make in their minds, in the way they think about each other, that then achieves kind of social form and discrimination and systemic form in segregation. And the American cultural mainstream embraced this particular way of thinking about racism. If you're thinking about racism this way, then anyone who's got race consciousness, any black nationalist group or white nationalist group, they all seem the same. They all seem prejudiced and biased by not approaching the world clearly without the lens of a partial identity and distortion.
And in fact, President Obama seemed to be saying that about Reverend Jeremiah Wright in his famous Philadelphia speech. He seemed to characterize people like Dr. Wright, like many of us, as suffering from some kind of mental defect occasioned by bad things that happened in the past that don't allow us to think straight in the present.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up. So in my opinion, there was a black nationalism, the real alternative to this integrationist understanding of racial justice and what racism consists of, achieved its real pinnacle of theoretic sophistication in the late 1960s and early 1970s with Malcolm X and his followers, the Black Panther ideologists, and others. The Reverend Wright episode, I think, is a very complex episode in which Obama is trying to simultaneously embrace a black identity. Before he renounced Reverend Wright, he said, "I could no more renounce Reverend Wright than I could renounce my own grandmother." I think he was simultaneously trying to embrace an identity without really a critical consciousness that there are different ways to embrace an African-American identity or a black nationalist identity. So one of the things I try to do in the book, one of the contributions I hope I make, is to provide a critical way for distinguishing between black nationalist groups. To me, there are right-wing and conservative black nationalist groups that I don't really want to ally with whatsoever. They're not progressive. And there are progressive, critical left nationalist groups that I, as a white progressive, am interested in forming coalitions with and moving forward with. So that's why I kind of pick Malcolm X and the Black Panthers as a very different articulation of black nationalism than, say, the ideology of the Nation of Islam or Africanist kind of back to Africa ideologies.
Manning Marable, the late Manning Marable, and Professor Peniel Joseph have attempted to portray Malcolm X as a kind of social democrat, non-black nationalist in the making, that his journey to liberal reformism was cut short by his assassination. Many of us think this is rank revisionism. What's your view?
I think there are some very interesting parts of Professor Marable's book, and there are some parts that I disagree with. I tend to agree with your analysis. I think Spike Lee was guilty of this, too. I think that the Malcolm X legacy has been misinterpreted by a lot of popularizers who saw in Malcolm X's renunciation of the Nation of Islam a movement toward integrationism. As I analyze it, what Malcolm X was renouncing when he moved away from the Nation of Islam was a right-wing kind of fundamentalist version of black nationalism in favor of a more critical left-wing version, again, that I would associate with the Black Panthers and other later figures in black nationalist ideology. So people look back at the Panthers and saw that the Panthers not only had programs for black liberation, but also had a critique of American involvement around the world as an imperialist exertion of influence, had critiques of capitalism, had critiques of gender relations, had broad-scale social theory critiques. They were a radical group. And people tend to think that those other social critiques were separate from the black nationalist part. What I try to argue in my book is that what integrationism does is it helps create a false ideology of what's going on in American society. And the nationalism as a kind of perspective is superior in exposing this. So from an integrationist point of view, since racism consists of bias and thinking about people differently, what you do is remove that bias, and what you're left with is kind of neutral, objective, meritocratic ways of distributing jobs or educations, distributing the good things in American life. So that in this way, integrationism kind of actually helps to apologize for the basic distribution of wealth, power, and prestige in American society. What critical black nationalists have recognized, well, in fact, maybe all black nationalists recognize this, is that what's taken as neutral and objective and unbiased once racism has been removed is actually the kind of starting point assumptions of a Eurocentric culture or whatever else it is. It's certainly a white culture, not an acultural, neutral way of being. So, for example, in law schools, I started teaching at the University of Virginia, which was formerly racially segregated. And the idea in an integrationist framework to transform and change that apartheid regime was to begin admitting black students. And that was what integration consisted of, taking down the white-only signs and admitting black students. But the fact is that apartheid ideology consisted of more than the simple fact of exclusion of dark-skinned people from the halls of that school. It was embedded in the whole consciousness of what law consists of, what rationality consists of, what it means to have a legal regime. And integrationism just can't conceptualize that those forms of racial power that are embedded in the day-to-day functioning of institutions. So integrationism allowed institutions to keep running without much kind of self-critique, nothing like the truth and reconciliation process that South Africa went through. There's arguments that that was vastly insufficient, but compared to what happened in the United States, it looks like a far more critical process.
And integrationism cannot really get its fingers around the term self-determination for black people. And I guess the victory of integrationism that you speak of is exemplified by the fact that we don't hear the term self-determination much these days.
You know, it's hard to figure exactly what's happened because I think we don't hear self-determination. But on the other hand, I think for progressive white people, most progressive white people don't believe in a kind of individualist, market-oriented social ideology. They believe in something like multiculturalism, a kind of pluralism. And so I think that my sense from within the white progressive community is that the white progressive community doesn't talk much about race issues out of a kind of unstated sense of honoring the self-determination of the African-American community, that one of the results of the ruptures in the 1970s between white progressives and left nationalists was white people never really returning to the black liberation struggle.
Well, I remember those days, and that white folks were forced out of several organizations that became all black organizations because the idea was that their very presence inhibited the political growth and activities of black folks in those organizations, especially the many people that these organizations were trying to reach out to, and that white activists were advised that since racism was really a problem coming from the white community, they should go and minister unto white people.
What I'm saying is that message was internalized very deeply among white progressives, so they basically at this point neglected the race issue. I think that that process was, again, I think somewhat complex, so that it's possible to analyze the groups of the late 60s and early 70s according to a grid of which ones were willing to do alliances with white groups and which ones weren't. And in my opinion, supported by some scholars like Harold Cruz, the more self-confident black nationalists who weren't scared that white people were going to run there, take over their organizations, like the Panthers, were quite open to coalitions. But the nationalist groups that had come out of formations where white radicals had been running things took a kind of harder, more fundamentalist black-only line on the organizations. I think that that all needs to be renegotiated if the white left and the black left is really going to move forward together on this continent.
Let me add that Dr. Gerald Horn has long said that the Nation of Islam is the indigenous right wing of Black America.
I think the Nation of Islam is a very clear example of what I would call a fundamentalist nationalist orientation, an orientation that takes nationalist identity. And it's the fact of group identity that really distinguishes a nationalist social approach from a liberal integrationist social approach, which takes individualism as the starting point. A fundamentalist approach is marked by taking certain characteristics of the group and deeming them essential and ahistoric and unchangeable. And to my mind, sadly, the Nation of Islam has taken certain elements of, say, patriarchy, patriarchal culture, and deemed them to be essential elements of African-American culture to be kind of taken out of historical development. So non-fundamentalist nationalist groups are more comfortable in allowing an African-American identity to be defined moment by moment in the flux of history and to be actually changeable and able to grow with time. So that it's sadly, I think, part of the repression of Black radical groups like the Panthers coming out of the 1970s that left the only nationalist groups standing as the, as you say, the indigenous right-wing nationalist groups.
Some of us on the Black left believe that this profound Black political crisis has come to a head because of the ascension, not just of a Black president, but a group that believes that Black progress can be measured by counting the number of Black faces in high places.
I think the crisis is profound. There is a kind of, I don't want to use the word collaboration, but the African-American middle class, I try to trace the roots of a compromise of the African-American middle class made with the white mainstream to basically accept more or less token integration into mainstream institutions as the definition of racial justice. And so the talk these days of post-racialism, as if the election of Barack Obama has signaled a new age, is, I think, a good example of the distortion of the lens of integrationism. Because from an integrationist point of view, the election of Barack Obama is the pinnacle of racial liberation. The exclusion from the most powerful job in the world has ended, and so that job is not racially exclusive anymore. But as we know, the quality of the lives of millions and millions of African Americans in North America has not changed materially or sadly even spiritually with the election of Barack Obama. Their loyal supporters are going to be marched off to the polls to support a continuation of a regime of non-fundamental change in terms of the redistribution of power or wealth or prestige in our society.
And yet this Black middle class, Professor Michael Dawson and his colleague Larry Bobo, say that in the many studies that they've done, they've seen very little difference in political orientation between the various economic classes of Black people. And that would tend to say that when we talk about this Black middle class feeling this way or that way and having made compromises, we may be talking about people who represent as representing the Black middle class and not the masses of people who actually fall into that category.
Well, I'm not talking about voting patterns. I'm talking about the sense in which, in the early days of integration, as masses of people were moving into the Black middle class, you heard things like, we have to go help the brothers and sisters left behind. We have to keep the bridges open to help everybody be lifted up. And so what I'm talking about is partly a crisis of a community, is the loss of that sensibility. And so regardless of the correct way that people might vote in terms of liberal social programs, the lack of a community consciousness, of a solidarity, of a sense of identity with people down the economic ladder is an important feature, I think, of the African-American community today. One of the things that I analyze in the book and I'm trying to exemplify is that for years it's been kind of off limits for a white leftist or progressive to talk analytically and critically about the African-American community and problems in the African-American community. The idea that you spoke of earlier from way back from the 70s, that this is really the job of self-determination, that only African-Americans should really be discussing this. So I'm just saying as an aside that I'm deeply gratified that you're open to a discussion from a white leftist of these dynamics within the African-American community.
We have white leftists on this show and in the print version of Black Agenda Report all the time. We believe that black folks are entitled to the best information and analysis possible.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It sounds like you're providing it.
Professor Gary Peller of Georgetown University in Washington. In Newark, New Jersey, the People's Organization for Progress, POP, is into day 337 of its demonstrations for jobs, housing, education, peace, and justice. That leaves only 44 days to go for POP to reach its goal of matching the 381-day longevity of the 1955 Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott. Jerry Owens is vice president of the Longshoremen's Union in the Newark area and president of the local A. Philip Randolph Institute. He's a strong supporter of POP's daily demonstrations.
Well, I think that made everybody knowledgeable of the situation with the city, with the city of Newark and the state of New Jersey and the United States of America, that there's things that need to be straightened out, things that need to be spoke about. And I think now POP has been really vocal and been a great asset to the city of Newark.
You, of course, are a high official in the Longshoremen's Local in the Newark area, and POP has been emphasizing the need for jobs.
Absolutely. In our industry, we have a hard time trying to bring in new people because of the Waterfront Commission of New York and New Jersey, who interfere with our collective bargaining. And that's one of the issues that we need to bring on the table.
And when we're talking about jobs, we're not just talking about units of jobs, but good jobs. And longshoremen's jobs have been considered for a long time, since you've been unionized, to be very good jobs.
And that's one of the struggles that we're having with this waterfront, that these people are trying to take away the things that we've had for many, many years. I've been a longshoreman myself for 54 years. My dad was a longshoreman, and my grandfather was a longshoreman, and my son is a longshoreman now. And nothing wrong, neither of us did anything that we are to be ashamed of, and we worked hard, and our families have lived well, and we want to continue like that. We have these commissions that are trying to take that away from us, which is not right.
For a number of years, the corporate media and a lot of other people have been behaving as if the time for demonstrations and raising hell about conditions is past.
By no means. Demonstrations will be going on forever. That's the only avenue we have, is to do what POP has done. Be out there and demonstrate and let people know that we're not satisfied with certain things. And that'll always be happening, I think. We'll always be demonstrating. We'll always be marching and fighting for what we think are things that are correct.
Longshoremen's Union official Jerry Owens in Newark, New Jersey. This month, Newark's mayor, Cory Booker, a right-wing Democrat and Obama supporter, expressed disgust at criticism of Mitt Romney's old firm, Bain Capital, and of finance capitalists in general. It was a bizarre spectacle for both Mayor Booker and President Obama. Black Agenda Report's Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
Barack Obama, Cory Booker, and the entire black political class have a problem. They must deliver the votes of their people to the campaign contributors who make their careers possible. Their voters oppose unjust wars, privatizations of public assets and services, and corporate bailouts. But once safely in office, these are exactly the measures Obama, Booker, and their colleagues enact. But right now, Barack Obama and other Democrats need to be reelected. And to be reelected, they must pose as at least half-hearted opponents of the blood-sucking model of parasitic vulture capital practiced by Bain Capital, J.P. Morgan, Citibank, and other players. It's not an easy act to sell, and sometimes Obama and his surrogates are caught in their own tangled webs. Romney's Bain Capital, like other vampire capital firms, don't just have relations with Democrats as well as Republicans. They have deep institutional and personal ties with leading members of the nation's black political class. Bain's business models, along with reams of their business advice in the form of pro bono transition and turnaround reports, recommending the mass firings of public workers, especially teachers, and the wholesale privatization of local water, government payrolls, parking meters, garbage pickup, parks and recreations departments, and everything that can or cannot be nailed down have been common staples on the desks of incoming black mayors in Newark, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Columbia, South Carolina, Atlanta, and other cities. When former Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin swept into office in 2005, her pro bono transition report was the Bain Report, put together by Mitt Romney's colleagues, intent on turning government services into lucrative business opportunities and pocketing the money saved by firing workers, reducing their benefits, and eliminating their pensions while jacking user fees for the public up to the maximum sustainable levels. Fortunately for Atlanta, the water privatization deal already done by Franklin's predecessor unraveled in spectacular fashion just as Franklin was entering office, creating a less favorable atmosphere for other immediate privatizations. Out of office, Franklin is now a lobbyist and consultant to firms specializing in the privatization of education and government services of all kinds. On last week's Meet the Press, Newark Mayor Cory Booker rose to the defense of parasitic vulture capital, declaring himself disgusted at what he called the useless rhetoric about how the nation's blood-sucking financial sector extracted its profits. Booker has its own relations with Bain and similar outfits, and looting the public sector at their behest is the very center of his mayoral administration. You wouldn't know it from the national media coverage, but Cory Booker has been a relentless advocate of privatizing Newark's water, parks, garbage collection, and a whole range of public assets and services, implementing the vampire capitalist model that Bain champions in Newark, New Jersey. It's not easy either for Barack Obama to pretend to be against what Bain Capital does when his former chief of staff William Daley, brother and son to longtime Chicago mayors, and one of the guys who wrote NAFTA, was a vice president at J.P. Morgan, a much bigger shark swimming in the same pool as Bain Capital. The Obama administration and its advisory bodies are riddled on every level with hundreds of vice presidents, lobbyists, and functionaries of vampire capital. Barack Obama knows where his real allegiances lie and what time of year this is. He will score a few rhetorical points at the expense of Bain Capital, but his heart belongs to J.P. Morgan. He knows, and we too should know, that talk is cheap.
That was Bruce Dixon, managing editor of Black Agenda Report, speaking from Atlanta. Earlier this month, the U.S. House defeated an effort to remove preventive detention of persons on U.S. soil from a defense spending measure. The defeat did not surprise Doug Valentine, who in 2007 co-wrote a paper on the history of preventive detention in the U.S. Valentine says, in modern capitalist states, the Constitution is just window dressing.
The fact of the matter is, the president, as the head of state, has the right to detain people. You can call it anything you want, and it happens in every country in the world. Your legal rights as an individual or as a group go out the window the minute the president says there's a national security threat. And that's just the way it is.
What use, then, is a constitution? What use are the Bill of Rights?
The Constitution and the Bill of Rights go right out the window, too. When it comes to the security of the state, the preservation of the state, and, you know, you have to certainly define the state as different than the general population. The state exists before the people do, in a sense. And this is the way the powers that be view it. And they say, well, without us preserving the state, you wouldn't even have a constitution.
We haven't heard President Obama say that the American state is in such a state of danger that preventive detention is required. We hear him, as we heard George Bush, speak of Americans being in danger, of Americans having enemies abroad and some here, but not that the state itself is in danger of being overthrown or collapsed or done away with.
It's come down to the point where some guy in India riding a bicycle down a street in New Delhi is a threat to the national security of the United States. And we got to know where this guy is going. what his name is and who his family is and who his friends are so that we can round him up and put him in, under surveillance so that he can't communicate with other some guy who's riding a bicycle in Malaysia. You know, it's just, it's beyond ridiculous. And to even have a conversation about administrative detention in the terms that the national security state and the executive branch leaders in the military and the intelligence services want to present it to us is counterproductive, because what you're doing is you're discussing the situation, this administrative detention situation, the definitions and the terms that they want you to talk about. But this is not what it's really about.
It seems that you were saying that what is going on is the government is conflating and inflating threats to U.S. interests with actual threats to the United States and the American way of life.
What has happened in the, 60 years since World War II, 70 years, is that the United States has been consolidating its position as the sole world power. And as communication and technology advance, the United States is not only, the United States security state is not only consolidating power in the United States, it's consolidating power around the world, and its foreign interests in occupying foreign countries and imposing its will on foreign countries is now equal almost to its need to have domestic security. So foreign intelligence, military occupation overseas, and domestic security are no longer separate things. And this tool, administrative detention, this weapon, administrative detention, is the way that the empire asserts and consolidates its power overseas. That's how important it is. It's how it actually identified every Vietnamese civilian, allowed for their rounding up and screening in detention centers so that they could try to identify who was leading the revolution against them. And this is what's happening in Afghanistan. It's what's happening in Iraq. It's happening in secret interrogation centers, CIA interrogation centers all over the world. And it's all done under the rubric of national security as a fight against terrorism. But it's not. What it is it's a way of consolidating power. It's a way of shoring up not just the empire overseas, but connecting foreign intelligence and domestic security.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.